Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about Hub Zero, a way for scientists to collaborate on really cool projects. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 428, recorded April 4th, 2017. Hub Zero. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Bitbucket from Atlassian. Bitbucket is the Git solution for professional teams. Start your free account today at bitbucket.org/forthecode. And by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. Since GoCD is open-source, you can download and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, visit gocd.io/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you may want to download or play with right after this show. Today's might be one of those. Joining me today, once again, Jonathan Bennett. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall. Good to be here.
Great. And where are you speaking to us from?
The corporate headquarters home office, Lawton, Oklahoma, on a beautiful day. Unfortunately, I had to close the windows because it was noisy outside, but it's gorgeous today.
It is also gorgeous today in downtown Santa Monica, where I come to you from the headquarters of ZipRecruiter, who graciously let me have one of their conference rooms for 3 hours every week while I'm here. So this is really nice. For those of you watching the video, you can actually see the skyline. It's actually a nice blue day today out there yesterday. Mm-hmm. So you can see the skyline behind me. And I'll be out there in that stuff probably at lunchtime. So it'll be nice and fun right after I get this show done. I'll probably be heading out there. But the show's not about this week in geography. The show is about open source software today. No exception to that. Today we're going to be talking about the Hub Zero project, which is a collection. It's a bunch of software. It's a software stack. It is specifically designed for scientific and engineering collaboration. So if you think about it, you know, you've got all these pieces you want to do. If you want to bring people together, you've got to have like some way to have, forums and upload data and coordinate on things, scheduling, things like that. Kind of thing that we might go today to for something like, Google that might, provide all that stuff for us. But it wouldn't be specialized in the way that engineers and researchers need that. So these guys got together through government grants initially, probably and a lot of other things in the meanwhile, and put together this collection of software that looks really, really slick. I've been checking out a few of their websites that are done with Hub Zero, and I'm really enjoying that. So we'll bring on a couple people in just a few minutes. We'll bring on Andy Burnett and Michael Zentner, who are going to talk to us about Hub Zero. Andy is the Andy is the CEO of No Innovation, which is a company that is providing consulting for various scientific groups that are using Hub Zero. And Michael Zentner is the director of Hub Zero. So they will be coming on in a few minutes. Jonathan, what do you know about this so far?
So this is the first that I've heard of it doing this show, and it strikes me as being kind of GitHub-ish. That might just be because of the name, though. And I'm okay. Curious kind of where it falls on the spectrum from something like GitHub to maybe it's more like Squarespace to, some other CMS. But I know very little about it, and I'm looking forward to learning about it and, you know, possibly putting it to use.
Well, and I'm thinking it's probably a lot better than GeoCities. So at least it looks a lot slicker than that. Now I've just dated myself because it's all the way back to the past. I think somebody tried to make a GeoCities clone at one point, but anyway, that was the way people used to collaborate and create low technology barrier websites. So this looks like a lot slicker way of doing all that. And now I probably just offended my guests, and they're hanging up on me now. But okay, but before we bring them on, if they're still here, I do have a very important message because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Bitbucket. Let's be honest, your code is your world. You create it, tweak it, and lovingly obsess over it every day. So picking the right repository management tool is super important. Only the best for your code, right? That's why the team at Atlassian created Bitbucket. Bitbucket is the Git solution for professional teams. It helps over 5 million developers build with a purpose. Bitbucket gives teams of all sizes free private repositories with state-of-the-art features. The world's best pull request algorithm. Pull requests facilitate code reviews. Collaborate right in the code with inline comments, threaded conversations, and mentions. Built-in continuous delivery. Branch permissions help prevent errors by controlling the actions users can perform. Get granular permissions at the project, repository, or branch level. Integrations with your favorite tools like Docker, AWS, and Azure. Because Bitbucket comes from Atlassian, it offers the best Jira integration available, giving your team everything you need to take your code from concept to customer. More than 900,000 teams love Bitbucket. It's used by companies like Ford, PayPal, Starbucks, and Pandora. It's the only collaborative Git solution that massively scales. Bitbucket is for the code that takes us to Mars, decodes the human genome, or drives your next car. Visit bitbucket.org/for the code to start your free account. That's bitbucket.org/for the code. Try Bitbucket today. What will your code do? And we thank Bitbucket for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guests. Let's start with Michael. Michael Zenner, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Randall.
Very cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm West Lafayette, Indiana, and Purdue University.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. I've flown over there, I think. Or actually, I think I've been to Purdue. So
a lot of people have flown over it.
Yes, not as a student. I sort of stopped my education at high school, which is apparently evident every once in a while when I do this show. Let's also bring on Andy Burnett. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Hi, and where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking to you from Buffalo, New York.
I've been there many times, too. Actually, I worked for the University at Buffalo. They told me to make sure to say it that way. Not University
That's
of
very
Buffalo.
True.
That's the other guys. Right.
Yeah.
University at Buffalo. I did a lot of work there over the years. In fact, one of my CPAN frameworks, the CGI prototype, was actually created there. So I actually owe them a lot. They definitely helped me out over the years. Did a lot of teaching there, a lot of programming there. Did a lot of really crazy stuff there as well. But that's not what this show is about today. The show actually shows about whatever I decide it is. But for the people at home, they want to know what this Hub Zero thing is all about. So, Michael, why don't we start with you? What's the 30,000 foot view? What problem is this solving?
Well, briefly, what Hub Zero does is it gives people a framework for taking their science and bringing it online. And it really straddles two different worlds. In your introduction, I noticed you talk a little bit about CMS, and it certainly has aspects of a CMS, but it also has aspects of what we call scientific middleware that allows us to provide access to high-end compute resources for people who want to run scientific simulations. So there was a little bit of discussion also in the introduction about GitHub, and the difference that I would draw between it and GitHub is GitHub is a place where you can go to get codes. Our hubs are typical places where you can go to run codes. So not all scientists that put codes onto a Hub Zero instance actually want those codes to be disseminated in their source version, but they do want other people to be able to access and run their codes. So really, with this straddling of these two worlds, what it allows people to do is it allows them to collaborate, as you talked about, to disseminate and publish information, and to enable resource and access sharing for these high-performance computing resources.
Well, that sounds really awesome. How did this get started?
If you go back in time now to about 1996, this was a vision of a professor at Purdue named Mark Lundstrom, who really just wanted to bring simulation tools online. And the project over the years since then became sort of a victim of its own success. The initial part of bringing those simulation tools online was very successful. And then people wanted to add more content to go along with those simulation tools. So hence the birth of the CMS side of what we do. And as time went on, we made it easier and easier for people to publish their simulation tools online. It grew and grew within the field of nanotechnology. At one point around 2004, people started asking the question, could you use that same infrastructure that you used to run what was called NanoHub at the time to run all kinds of scientific communities? So out of that, the Hub Zero software was extracted as a core framework and then disseminated as an open source project to run many other scientific communities. So today, we're not just running nanotech communities, but we're running earth science, biology, healthcare engineering, climate research, STEM education, social science, and a variety of other sites and different sciences.
Well, that's fascinating. So this idea then that you're providing not only a CMS and a connection facility, but providing a way to basically be software as a service. What are some of the complications of that?
The complications come with expectations of various clients. Developing a platform like this is challenging because a lot of times our users are scientists, not infrastructure programmers, and our team is primarily infrastructure programmers. So in some sense, our team doesn't necessarily live in our customer's shoes on a day-to-day basis. So it's challenging for us to really understand what's going on in the scientific workflow and how to embody that in what we do from a development perspective. This is beginning to change. More and more scientists are starting to straddle those two worlds, but when this all started, they certainly didn't. We have additional challenges in that we work in a university environment, which means that we have to support ourselves while we do this work and in sort of the university way. And even the fact that we've been around for quite some time has provided some challenges for us because a project that now you can kind of think of as about 20 years old needs to continually recognize the point at which it needs to reinvent parts of what it does. And this is something that you really have to step back and take a look at periodically.
Well, I really like, as I was looking at some of the demonstration sites, I see that they're really... we used to call it Web 2.0, but basically just fancy. It's the word now. Or doesn't look like Web 1.0. I think that's really the only important thing. I see you're using jQuery UI, lots of good animations, things like that. I presume that obviously those weren't in there 10 years ago. So at what point do you start thinking about adding that sort of stuff to make it more enticing for the intended audience?
Well, we typically look for tipping points. For example, if you look at some of the ways we've run simulation tools in the past, we've provided a VNC window within a browser to do high performance rendering on a back-end render server and provide that experience through a browser window. But as you look at the way that those same kind of delivery mechanisms are evolving today, particularly, say, with Jupyter Notebooks, you see that a lot more of this kind of activity can be done on the client side. And we look at innovations, for example, Jupyter, and see at what point is it sort of not just an isolated experiment that's going on in a few labs here and there to a point where it's actually impacting an awful lot of users, an awful lot of scientists. And that's sort of when we make the decision that those are things that we think we'd like to bring into the core of what we do.
Cool. Okay, we'll give Andy a chance to talk for a second here. Andy, what's your relationship to the project? And also, can you tell me more about what No Innovation is?
Well, we got involved with the project about 5 years ago. I was invited by the previous director, who, for reasons of backward compatibility, was also known as Mike. They don't like to introduce breaking changes. But so Mike version one asked me to come and talk at their annual conference, which is called Hubbub. And it sounded interesting. And the kind of work my colleagues and I do is we're interested in the intersection of the psychology of creativity and scientific research. So from our point of view, we sort of study scientists studying science. And for a number of years, we'd been experimenting with how we could use technology to build networks of scientists so that we could support the activities when we're face-to-face and think about how do we support it remotely. And for a while, we'd been using a platform called Ning, which I think is still around and had proved to be interesting, but it was closed source and there were lots of things we wanted to do to it. So when Mike invited me to come and talk at the conference, I thought, great. I knew nothing about HubZero, but I sort of turned up and chatted. And then they showed me what HubZero actually did. And I thought, wow, that's fantastic. That's just what we're looking for. So I said to the team, I'll go back and talk with my colleagues and we should experiment with it. But I made the mistake somewhere along the way of mentioning to one of our clients, which was a big academic funding agency, I said, we'd found this really interesting software. Now, that's what I said. But what they heard is, we'll have a system running for you next Wednesday. And that gave us a problem. So it sort of gave us a level of commitment to the project, which I hadn't anticipated. But I sort of spoke with a few of my colleagues, and they said, yeah, it can't be that hard. I mean, it's a well-documented open source project. We'll spin it up on Amazon. No problem. And that was the point at which we sort of joined the project in the role that we still hold, which is the people who ask really annoying questions about, and why doesn't this bit work? And we've been delighted to hold that role ever since. Part of the reason for that was I hadn't understood when I was talking with this group that really this was at the time a Purdue project serving to a large extent a sort of Purdue-oriented community and beyond, but it was the sort of thing where everything was being managed by Hub Zero. And as we all know, whenever we've developed software for ourselves and somebody comes along and says, could I use it too? And you go, sure, have it. And then they come back and they go, yeah, but it didn't work. Oh, yeah, you've got to stand on one foot because there was a reason why I did it that way. And so that was kind of the transition that we became, I think, one of the first organizations that had kind of taken it as its word of saying, oh, here's a project, you can use it. And we have been learning ever since.
Awesome. I was interesting that you mentioned Ning. I do remember Ning back in the day. And one of the things I remember about it is it went through some sort of, you know, 62-degree left turn at one point, where it was one thing for a long time, and then all of a sudden it became something else. It's the same mistake MySpace made when they were originally about artists finding their audience. And then they innovated MySpace, innovated it, right, to version 2 of MySpace. And all of a sudden, all the fan bases they built up, all gone, even though – and right. it's just never succeeded after that. I think Ning had that same sort of 62-degree left turn that ruined it. So it's interesting that you brought that up. So this is – does this look like it's best of breed in this space then? I mean, you're still supporting it and enjoying it and working with it. So have you found anything else that's even close at this point?
I mean, there are, well, basically, when you get more than two academics together, a project emerges from it and everyone thinks they can write their own software. And this time it'll be fantastic. And, you know, 80% of it is. It's just the other 20% that doesn't. We have had a sort of up and down relationship with Hub Zero, and that's largely because it was a little bit like when I moved to the States 10 years ago. For the first year, I thought I understood everything. And then the next year, you go, do you know, I don't understand anything about this country. And it sort of goes up and down. And with Hub Zero, when we span it up to start with, it was fantastic. We could put all the modules in there. I thought, that's brilliant. And then you would try and do something which hadn't been done before. And you'd go, I don't understand how this works at all. So there's definitely been a learning curve with that. But I think it has huge potential, and particularly in about the last year, the Hub Zero team, and we now help to sort of contribute to code on this, and we nudging from Mike said this beautifully in an email a while ago. He said, we were a free project and we're now trying to become an open project. And that's a large part of why I suggested we try and come on this show to figure out how do we build a community around this. And how do we take advantage of all the wonderful integrations that people are creating? Because at its core, Hub Zero is great. We've achieved so much with it. And I think it's a wonderful example of what you can do with an open source project when you really can build on it.
I'm reminded of a graphic that talks about the two states of every programmer, one saying, I am a god when things work, and then the other one going, I have no clue how any of this works. works. That reminds me of what you described there. And I think that moment comes for every project where something works and then the next time something just doesn't work. I'm still kind of trying to wrap my mind around all the things that this does. Would it be fair to say that to some extent it's kind of a cloud-based interface for working with supercomputers? Because you mentioned HPC, high performance. Is it a replacement for Amazon and Amazon Cloud? Tell me a little bit about how that works, what you're accomplishing there.
Yeah, it's not a replacement for Amazon or Amazon Cloud. In fact, we use these infrastructures ourselves as compute venues. Most recently, we've had an integration with Microsoft Azure. What it is it's a front end to those systems that provides the actual applications that consume those compute resources. So I may publish an application that simulates a transistor, and there may be 100 or 10,000 people in the world that are interested in running that same application, and they can do that by accessing the application on a hub and the back-end compute resources that we provide so that maybe some universities that don't have the same resources that the rest of the world has can access those resources through a gateway like one of our hubs. We sort of fall into a class of software that's emergingly being called science gateways. Mm-hmm. And the term gateway arises from providing application access to those cloud resources. Now, we are a cloud provider of services, just one level higher than just the raw compute power itself. Does that make sense?
I think so. So you're trying to take, again, we'll talk about Amazon Cloud because we all know what that is. Most of us have used it. You're trying to take the capabilities of Amazon Cloud and lower the barrier to entry so that, you know, an undergrad student can go and through the Hub Zero project, could go and run something very interesting without having to spin up his own instance of Amazon Cloud and go through all of those steps. Is that the advantage that it makes it easier to get to?
Right. They have no clue where they're running the codes that they're running. They could be running on Amazon. They could be running on national resources like Exceed. They could be running on clusters we have here at Purdue University. All they care about is they click a button to simulate and they get an answer back.
Okay. So do they have to pay any money to be able to click that button? How does the funding work for this?
No, it's all free now. How the funding works is it's really a combination of things. We are a self-supporting team at Purdue, currently 25 professionals big. And what we do is we have a combination of large research projects that really guide some of our strategic initiatives, and then a lot of smaller research projects that pay us to do the hosting and maintenance services for their hubs. So for people like that, we provide full-time customer service representatives, security experts, continuous patching, and in some cases, we provide HIPAA compliance, depending on the data needs of the people who are running a particular hub. So people do take our hub code, download it, and run their open versions of the hub. But also there are those academic collaborations where they look at our hosting costs and add it up, and it looks like less than the cost of a grad student. So sometimes they would rather us just deal with all that hassle.
Is Hub Zero actually now a for-profit business?
No. Hub Zero is a business unit within Purdue University still. We are not a for-profit. We do have a foundation, but the function of the foundation really is to own the contributions to the code, the core code, and as a mechanism for some people like to buy consulting services from us, and they can do that through the foundation sometimes a lot easier than they can trying to make a contract with the university.
Mm-hmm. We do have a chat room that, you know, people watch live and have a couple of questions from there, which we appreciate. Oz from Chicago wants to know, do you guys have a, I believe he says, dedicated security group?
We do. We have a dedicated PhD in security and a couple of sysadmin folks that fill in part-time with them as well. But it's particularly important to us as we've gotten into applications that deal a lot more with healthcare and all the data security compliance activities that we have to undertake to inspire confidence in the people that use the tools and supply the data on our platforms.
And not get hit with massive HIPAA fines. Yes, I'm familiar with how that works.
And jail time today, too, if you're purposely negligent.
And then from Gamarel, we have a question. Can anyone use the service, or is this restricted to nonprofits or scientific or academic applications?
That's entirely open to the terms that a particular hub owner has when they run their own hub. So we don't manage the rules for the various hubs. We do allow them to have their own terms of usage. So we will have some hubs that will specifically say, this really isn't for commercial usage. It's only for pre-competitive research. We'll have other hubs that are very open to commercial participation. And really, that's something that we try not to get involved in other than to give them the means of putting up their own terms of use.
What license is the code licensed under?
The code is, I believe we have one little bit of GPL license code still, and that's on its way out, and then it'll be an open Apache license.
Apache, okay. Now, we talk about high-performance computing and, you know, using a whole bunch of resources from Amazon or Azure. What kind of projects are we talking about that need this kind of computing power?
Two kinds of projects. Some projects will have a very mathematically intense simulation that requires high-speed interconnects between the processors. So these would be highly parallelized codes, not the typical embarrassingly parallel codes. And those we would have a little bit of a challenge running on something like Amazon. Microsoft is providing an infrastructure that will do that. But then we have a whole different kind of code that really just runs a lot of embarrassingly parallel runs for the purposes of doing optimizations. So you might think about some engineers trying to design a new clamp that goes into an automobile, and they want to minimize the weight of that clamp, but at the same time, they don't want it to break. And one of the ways they do this is they queue up literally thousands of simulations that sort of find the sweet spot of weight versus strength of a material. And we see a lot of that kind of stuff in engineering applications.
Is anyone mining Bitcoin with it yet?
I haven't seen that, no.
All right.
This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by GoCD. GoCD is an on-premise, open-source continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks. With GoCD's comprehensive pipeline modeling, you can model complex workflows across multiple teams with ease. GoCD can easily configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment with its parallel and sequential execution. Its fan-in, fan-out dependency management always does the right thing, avoiding spurious builds. The value stream map lets you track a change from commit to deploy at a glance. GoCD's real power is in the visibility it provides over your end-to-end workflow, so you can get complete control of and visibility into all your deployments across the organization. GoCD also offers complete customization for your software's individual needs. GoCD will perform tests written in most languages or frameworks. Their test reporting will tell you in exactly which change set and on which platform a test started breaking. You can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when troubleshooting a broken pipeline. GoCD supports auditable deployment and can delegate the configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges. GoCD has extension points for which plugins can be created, and numerous plugins are available for you, or you can write your own. Say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. GoCD is open source that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. And now, Jonathan, you had another question?
So when this project first got started, was it funded entirely by Purdue? Were there any government grants involved? How did all that spin up and get started?
It was funded at the very initial part, I believe, by a little bit of funding from Purdue. But since the point of 2002, it's been funded primarily by research grants. The initial one of these was a grant called the Network for Computational Nanotechnology from the National Science Foundation. And this has been an ongoing project called NanoHub now for actually 15 years. But as we've grown beyond just that one project into many other projects now, funding comes from a variety of different government agencies, from private foundations, and even in some cases from for-profit corporations. So we've really been working hard to diversify our funding sources. As you know, funding for science in the U.S. is a kind of an uncertain thing at the present time, and it's very important for us to look at how to insulate ourselves against these kind of uncertainties.
Let's give Mike a little bit of a break here for talking. Andy, is this difficult to set up? And if I'm not that skilled in setting up this kind of a thing, is that the kind of thing I would come to you guys for to help me set it up?
No, I wouldn't recommend that at all. No, but so it has become a lot easier to set it up. One of the things that happened a little while after we got involved with it was because we didn't have the servers that Purdue did, we said, okay, so we'll run it on Amazon on the AWS stack. And there was a lot of messing about, but eventually we got it running, and that was great. And then the HubZero team said, well, that's interesting. Maybe we should be able to do that as well. And so through a number of conversations, it turned out that one of the things that you can do on AWS is you can create an image which you can actually charge for, at least to some extent. And that seemed like an interesting experiment for HubZero to do, because it gave them, as Mike was saying, sort of a small but measurable income stream for people who wanted to be able to do that. So I think probably you can download a VMware image and just run it on your local machine, and that will go. But if you wanted to share it with other people, then using the HubZero image, which you can get from the Amazon store, I think is probably your easiest way to go. Having said that, we find we can probably spin up a new server in an hour or so. And just recently, we've started doing the experiment of using Amazon's Aurora database, their replacement for MySQL, and connecting, because the current setup is that you run everything within one instance, your database and your PHP code and all the rest of it. So we wanted to separate that out, and we've got that running now. And that's proving actually to be a pretty good way to run it. So you can have, we tend to run it on small AWS instances and use Aurora or the RDS system to do the data management on it. So now a couple of hours and you would have a shareable instance if you didn't want to use the image that they've created specifically for you to get started. I think one other thing I wanted to say was Mike's been talking quite rightly about the high performance computing side of this. But there are at least two other ways that I think people think about HubZero or what attracts them to it. When we got involved, we went, wow, tool virtualization, that's impressive. We have no use for that whatsoever, but it's nice to know if we ever wanted to come back to it, then it would be there. But HubZero, it's got this idea of sort of, as Mike was saying, it's how you bring your science online. So a lot of science requires citation and publishing and the idea of DOIs, document identifiers. So you can say, here are my data. There is a data set here. Here is the DOI to get to it. And so there are significant library management functions within that, and there are HubZero sites which have really focused on that. Again, we weren't interested in that. But the third part, which was about being able to create groups, to have discussion fora and wikis and that sort of thing. That mm-hmm. was the part that we were particularly interested in. And it's very good for that. You can, for instance, if we're running an event and we say, okay, we've got 100 people who want to come together to talk about some aspect of biology, we will press a button, it spins up a group within our overall Hub Zero instance, and you can then invite people into that. They can have the discussions, they can see who else is coming. It's a place for them to store all of the documents and that sort of thing. Now, clearly, there are alternatives, as you mentioned earlier. We could do it with a Google site or things like that. But the great appeal to us of Hub Zero is that we can easily build in all sorts of other tools. And at the moment, we're really trying to think through which parts of what we're trying to do belong on a server rendered through PHP and that sort of traditional monolithic stack, and which parts should really be running on the client. And we've been doing some experiments integrating, for instance, there's a database, funnily enough, a Google product called Firebase, which is a yes. real-time database. And so we've been using Hub Zero to give us sort of the container and the user management. And then within that, we've been experimenting with things like Polymer and Firebase to be able to give little sort of widgets in there which give us exactly what we want and which wouldn't make sense to write as a back-end driven application. So I think there are these three different areas of high-performance tool virtualization, publishing, and then community. And obviously, for something like NanoHub, which has a huge number of users, then all three might apply. But if you were really interested in document management and publishing, then you might still want to use Hub Zero, but just not install or not run other aspects of it.
Cool. I'm really happy you mentioned Firebase and also Polymer, too. I've been tracking those projects for a while as well. So is this thing... From the perspective of just being like a scientist, as opposed to maybe a scientist who's also a programmer, or like me, a programmer who's not a scientist, what do I need to know to be able to make this customized to my installation? Do I need to know programming? Do you need to know how to go in and dig in and change code around? Do I need to know HTML? I mean, is this more of a CMS level usage and interaction?
I think there are different aspects to that. If you wanted to do tool virtualization, and if we take an example, something like, in fact, I just saw a Slack message just appear a moment ago from the development team. They are looking at how they integrate R and RStudio. And so you could imagine if you were building some kind of simulation that might be about public engagement with science or something like that, and you wanted to publish local environmental data, but you didn't want everyone to have to run R, then this is the sort of thing that you would want to use, or at least it's an option. And right. I think configuring the tools, if you assume someone has set the stack up for you, then actually creating spaces, configuring tools, that sort of thing, it's all done through the web admin interface. And once you get the once you understand the naming convention, so what's a module, what's a component, what's a tool, those sorts of things, then you can do that yourself as long as you have the privileges to do it. And in the last year, I think the Hub Zero team have really made a big leap forward in terms of their documentation. They have monthly sort of drop-in sessions. They do a lot of tutorials. I'm so tempted to commit them to all sorts of other things now because they can't stop me. but you know, I'm just going through mentally the wish list of all the things I need them to do. Right. So it's become much easier to engage with the team and to get yourself going. So yeah, you can do that.
Cool. Michael, let's give Andy a chance to take a break here for a second. Michael, what's on the roadmap? What are you still missing that's really like at the top of your list? And if you could only get some more people to help you with, that would be the next thing you would tackle.
Well, as Andy said earlier, if you get two academics together, you get a project. If you get four academics together, you get 16 projects, and they keep growing like that. And really, what we've come to is a change in philosophy in what we do. We, for a long time, have had a philosophy that we would build everything ourselves. And today there are so many libraries and API-based functionalities that you can access in the world that we're changing that emphasis to try to integrate with many other tools as opposed to building tools ourselves. And this is all geared toward getting more into the daily workflow of what scientists do with the tools mm-hmm. that they natively use to do those things. So one of the things we're really interested in is getting people who are interested in integrating these third-party tools into HubZero and making a meaningful experience with those tools in combination with some of the other facilities that are in HubZero. For example, you look at instant collaboration tools like Slack, and we look at people who are running data analytics applications or simulations on our hub that would like to have that kind of instant collaboration right in the middle of a simulation session. Mm-hmm. And we view that as kind of an integration activity that would be very compelling and interesting for our scientists to use because they already use those two things in isolation. So these kind of things are really where we're going in the future. And these are the kind of things that we're interested in finding people who really want to help with providing those kind of integrations, bringing larger audiences to the software and having those audiences spend more of their daily time working with things that are connected to a HubZero hub.
And give us sort of the high-level view, maybe the top 5 or 10 components of what HubZero actually is. I mean, I'm sure there's a web server in there somewhere, but enumerate those for me.
Sure. Content management system with its backend database, web server, middleware for connecting to HPC resources. And today, some of the big things that we're embedding into the software, as the development team informed Andy to talk about, are Jupyter and R and things that are third-party tools, but which are being embedded into our framework as well to provide that value and get some of these million people who are using these scientific productivity tools into doing some of the other things they can also do with a hub.
And so the parts of the project that are like the configurable parts, is that like PHP, I guess? Or I mean, what kind of languages do you need to know to be able to plug things in and build out more stuff?
We're primarily the LAMP stack. That said, we are doing experiments with some of our larger projects on things like ClojureScript, on different kinds of databases, particularly in one case using React in a healthcare application. But, you know, basically you can get started by having a good understanding of the LAMP stack. But that doesn't preclude you from adding other things to a given instance of a hub if those particular things are merited for the application.
Of course, when I hear LAMP stack, I hear Perl instead of PHP. So I just want to make it clear that you're talking about the PHP LAMP stack, not the Perl LAMP stack.
And did you have compatibility?
Do you have compatibility with, I heard MySQL, but is there also, I guess there was also some RDS stuff in there, which would be Postgres. Are we kind of independent of the back end?
Primarily, we're using MySQL.
Okay. All right. Well, sorry for that. Anyway, now Monty's going to be mad.
I've got one developer that agrees with you.
Hey, Monty. Monty's a good friend of mine. He gets me my drinks for free occasionally at conferences. I hear Jonathan's got a couple more questions, so we'll go to him first. Then we'll probably start wrapping up.
Okay. So these are. One of them is more serious than the other. We talked a little bit about how much this scales. Does it scale all the way down to the point where we could put it on something like a Raspberry Pi?
This must be done as an experiment.
It must be done.
Make it so.
You guys in the chat room, it's up to you now. Go put it on a Raspberry Pi. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
And the more serious component of that question is it... is this something that is changed to x86? Or, you know, we hear in the coming years that, you know, ARM servers are going to become a thing. Is your tool chain and all of that set up to where that's something that would be possible to run it on ARM machines?
I don't see why it wouldn't necessarily be possible. I'm pretty sure that it wouldn't be an immediate drop-in. And I think, you know, Andy and I discussed a little bit beforehand the roadmap of how we undertake development. And this is one of those things that we'd have to see our core audience was adopting sort of at a fast pace for us to sort of certify that kind of operation and get in and make sure that worked on a scalable way for the way we distribute our code.
I just want to add in here because I didn't see it anywhere on the website. I saw the VMware image and I saw the ability to install it from sources and stuff. But are you looking at providing Docker chain container services for this?
Actually, yes. One of the guys on the team wanted me to mention that he's working on and shortly will distribute ways to do this with Docker, and he's got a Vagrant setup as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is wonderful. That means now there I have one less excuse to not play with this. You guys, you're supposed to make it hard for me so that I can actually do something for the rest of the week for the next show that I have to do instead of being stuck on this thing. But is No Innovation hiring? I think I want to quit my job and come over and play with you guys. So
more than happy to. Yeah, come on over.
Oh, great. Oh, cool. No, don't say that. No. You're too far east. I don't want to be off the West Coast, but maybe they can work remotely. I'm just scrambling now. Okay. We've talked about a lot of things, but we're almost out of time. Is there anything we haven't covered that you want to make sure people are aware of about Hub Zero and the related projects before we let you go? For both of you.
I think the thing that one thing that we'd really want people to understand is that the project, we're making big efforts to really build a community around this. And we're in early stages on this. I mean, so I'm sure there are lots of mechanics yet to be worked out. But if you have any interest in this at all, do please get in touch because we really want to build the community, and it, particularly for what Mike was saying about, we're really looking to get integrations built in. So anyone who's got any interest in that, please get in touch, and we will work out the sort of drumbeat of how the community needs to operate.
Awesome. And Michael, same question?
I would second what Andy says. this really has been a change in the way we think about doing business. But it's time. We're a project that's at a crux for that kind of transition, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes out of that effort.
Awesome. Okay, now I got two final questions that if I don't ask, my audience actually emails me and says, why didn't you ask those questions? So first from Michael, what is your favorite scripting language and what text editor do you use all day?
What text editor? When I'm not forced to use Microsoft Word VI.
Okay. All right.
And pretty much the only language I use it anymore for anything is Python.
Python. Well, okay. We'll take that as a no in both categories.
I'm not the day-to-day developer here. So.
Okay, that's fine. We let managers use Python. It's okay. And Andy, same two questions for you.
I only really program in Smalltalk because everything else just makes me feel tired. And you go, what do you mean I can't right-click on that object and go through the entire history of its browser? And I suppose for text editing, I do a lot in Smalltalk. But I have to admit, given the way you are holding on tooth and nail with Emacs, it does give me the encouragement to go and see, maybe I should learn that. So Smalltalk and possibly Emacs.
Well, I think you're the first person to say Smalltalk. Now, I learned Smalltalk back with the original 1980 image when it was running on the Magnolia from Tektronix. So that, yeah. I go way back with Smalltalk. And I was trying to make Smalltalk popular in 2008, but that sort of went by the wayside because the economy tanked about the same time I was trying to do that. So I'm back to mostly coding in Perl and stuff. But yeah, I know I learned objects in Smalltalk. I teach objects from the way I learned it in Smalltalk. I'm still annoyed that Smalltalk didn't catch on. because you're right, it's such an amazingly strong environment, amazingly productive environment that I'm glad there's still a few of you out there that are also being an advocate for it. So I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Well, guys, it's been fun. Again, you guys made me want to download this thing and play with it right after the show. And I say that in the opening because it actually happens for me most of the time. I really appreciate you guys talking about Hub Zero and about its impact in society and where you want it to go. Thank you, Michael and Andy, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Awesome. That was Michael Zinter and Andy Burnett talking to us about Hub Zero. What do you think, Jonathan?
So it's a very interesting niche that they've got there with trying to get collaboration between different people interested in the same scientific questions and trying to do the, so probably the most interesting thing that sets them apart is that they're trying to do the data processing as a part of the collaboration platform, which I think really that's going to, as they grow it and as more people come on board, there's potential for some really interesting things happening there that they talked about a little bit. I could see, I wish we had time to, as always, I wish we had more time to talk to him, but wish we had time to ask him something about instead of doing scientific calculations, could you replace that back end with the ability to do daily builds and use this as a collaboration platform for programming for other projects? So there's some really interesting things that could come in the future, and definitely a project to keep our eyes on and see what happens.
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. This thing, again, as always, we can always go another half hour or an hour with this show. And I try to keep this right under an hour, guys, because I know there are some other shows that I used to listen to, used to watch, that have crept up to being 2 hours now. That's unsubscription time. So you guys all know that. Anyway, I'm not saying anything bad about any of my fellow shows on the Twit Network. But anyway, but I'm keeping this to an hour. I'm really, really careful keeping this hour. But now back to the project. This looks like it's got a lot of got a critical mass of collaboration, like just the word collaboration and publishing and stuff all fit into this in a way that I really haven't seen anything else out here that looks like that. I mean, yeah, you can install a WordPress instance or something and get some of this, but not the way these guys seem to have done it. And I like the freshness, I like the innovation. I'm looking forward, as you said, I'm looking forward to see where this project goes in the future as well. And I like that at this point right now, they're putting out a call for community so that other people are going to get involved and other people are going to do integrations and stuff. And that's going to really make this be a key player as we move forward. And I'm glad we had him on Floss Weekly today. Anything else before we start wrapping up?
It'll be interesting to see if they get to the point to where they're self-hosting their collaboration community. The people working on it are using the project itself to do some of the work. It would be an interesting snake eats its own tail.
The Hub Zero site is in Hub Zero, so that's what it says
there
right at the bottom. So they're already self-hosting, and I like that, that they're using this as their primary entry site is already one of their own instances, and I think that says a lot for it already, because as soon as you get to be self-hosting, the sky's the limit. So anyway, we're almost out of time. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you learn a lot about your project and your code when you actually have to use it to self-host. Lots of annoyances pop out and lots of things that could be made better, get made better because you have to use it.
Things with which you will not put, no, what's the right way to say that in English? Apparently, I stopped my education at the end of high school. It's pretty obvious now. Anyway, and yet I'm a professional writer and trainer, and I've taught college-level classes. Anyway, here we go. Coming up next week, PG Backrest. That's Postgres Backup and Restore Software. Following week is Screen Studio, but that will be on a Wednesday, not on a Tuesday, because we're getting preempted for some, I think, Facebook event or something. So the Screen Studio records and streams your full-res desktop and webcam. Following that, Stacky, bare metal provisioning tool from the creators of Rocks. Following that, the Beneficial Dictator for Life is Benevolent Dictator for Life, not beneficial. Either way, Jason Hubbard is going to come to it, talk to us about FreeNAS in his latest project in that arena, FreeNAS Corral. So you can actually have network-attached storage that is in clusters, which is going to be even more cool. Following that, I'll be at OSCON. Don't know who the guest will be, but there'll be some guest live. Whoever I find on Monday that's willing to take some time on Tuesday gets to be on the show. That's how it basically works. Following that, we have an update from Kubernetes, speaking of clouds and containers and stuff. We last talked to them back in August 2015, but a lot has happened since then. And that's the orchestration software for Docker-based systems. NPM, following that, you've heard of Node.js. NPM, of course, is the command you type in. It's also the whole company behind Node.js. And we're going to have them on talking about how they make money doing this, I guess. Thank you, Simon Phipps, for bringing us that intro. A lot more slots still open, working on those, trying to fill those, sending out my flurry of email every week to try to invite guests. And, of course, I'm going to be at the Red Hat Summit and then immediately follow that by OSCON. So hopefully there'll be a big pile of future guests. But if you have somebody that I haven't gotten to yet that you want on the show, the way to have that work is you go to the project community coordinator or the project leader, and you have them email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My address is on the homepage for the show, twit.tv/floss. And from there is also the big spreadsheet linked that has all the upcoming guests that I'm already working on or currently scheduled. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time, usually on Tuesdays, at live.twit.tv. We took quite a few questions from there today. That was really fun. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+, and also follow me, Floss Weekly, the Twitter handle. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google+. That's sort of where my primary blogging platform these days. That gets also linked over to my Twitter handle, Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N. Again, I said I'm going to be at Red Hat Summit coming up in a few weeks. That's going to be in Boston. So if you're in the Boston area, please watch my tweets, and maybe we can hook up after hours somewhere. I'm also going to be at OSCON in Austin in the middle of summer. So it's going to be hot. It's always hot there when they go there in Austin. Okay. Again, if you see me in any of these places, please stop by, say hi. I'm going to be at YAPSE, the Yet Another Pro Conference, in the Research Triangle area, I think it is. No, D.C. Sorry, just outside D.C., which will be fun. And again, I'll watch my tweets and you'll figure out where I'm at. And then I'm also going to be at DragonCon in September, in Hot Atlanta in September. Hopefully they will have fixed I-85 before I get there, but who knows what that's going to do to the traffic. It's really a mess. Anything you want to plug, Jonathan?
No, I'm staying busy on the day-to-day stuff and kind of keeps me from getting out and going to some of these conferences. Although one of these days I'll start on the conference trail, but not today. It is not this day.
All right. All right. Well, Jonathan, thanks once again for being my co-host to help me answer questions. Help me ask questions. See, I'm just getting giddy now. This is obviously towards the end of the day, the end of the show anyway. So thank you, Jonathan, for joining me once again. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.